Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, it's the Ruler Podcast. It's September and Cross is coming. Well, actually, it's already come. The first round of the UCI World Cup was yesterday, the Jingle Cross in Iowa. Paul Maunder has written an excellent book about cyclocross, Rainbows in the Mud, and he's also written a piece in Ruler 17.7 about Tom Pidcock, the young British rider who's been winning races in the mud, on the track and on the road with remarkable ease. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
We'll be discussing Tom Pidcock and cyclocross in a little while. Ruler executive editor Ian Cleverley is here as well, just back from a trip to Canada. What was that about? Or a boot, as they say in Canada.
I didn't hear anybody say a boot, but maybe I wasn't...
Maybe it's a myth.
Trained. I went over for the two races, which are Grand Prix Quebec and Montreal. Good fun. Good races. I say good races. First one was a bit dull, to be honest. But good trip overall. I've never been to Canada before, so.
What are the events like?
Well, these two are absolutely top notch. I mean, and that's kind of really their selling point. They attract a top class field by not only transporting everybody over in a chartered plane, but looking after them really well. You get the most amazing hotel in Quebec, which is quite phenomenal. It's like a castle. And so hence you've got Sagan and Dumoulin and Greg Van Avermaet, you know, all the top boys go. And I think a big part of the attraction is because they're so well looked after.
So it's a nice way to end the season.
Exactly. I mean, your options then are the Vuelta, which obviously you don't want to do if you just finished a Grand Tour, the Tour of Britain, a bit cold and wet, or the two races in Canada. And it's a long way to go for two races, but it does have its attractions.
Okay, well, before we talk about anything else, the Giro d'Italia 2018 will begin in Israel. The organisers of the Giro, RCS, announced their decision in Jerusalem this week. It may yet prove controversial, not least with the two pro teams which are sponsored by Arab states. Ruler's Richard Abram caught up with the Giro organiser Mauro Venier and asked through a translator what had influenced the decision. Was Israel simply the highest bidder?
Candidature per il 2018 ce n'erano altre.
For 2018 edition, we had other proposals, but they were all European-based. Israel wasn't, obviously, and that was the deal-breaker, much more than the budget involved. Why? Because in the last 15 years, the view of the Giro has been to growing internationally and having an international raised international profile. And the chance to start outside of Europe was big, and the relevance of a start in an important area such as this one convinced the whole organization that that was a unique opportunity.
Di vedere il Giro nel mondo.
And so the Giro has already started in Northern Ireland in 2014, and there's been talk of having a start in the US and Japan as well. Do you think that the Giro has to make a bit of a splash and to ruffle a few feathers maybe, particularly because of how dominant and how big the Tour de France is now, that the Giro has to do something to stand out from the crowd?
Intanto ci tengo a dire che per una volta...
For once, being first before the Tour, I don't particularly dislike the position in which I am.
Credo che sono d'accordo con lui.
He agrees with you. Yes, there are probably some ruffled plumage around. I'm sure about it.
Questo non per.
This is not to fight the power of two, but it's to show the world that there are other races and other partners that can be as big, as unique as the Tour de France in the same space.
So obviously, the situation on a political level in Israel is very complex. Are you concerned? Do you think that there might be perhaps a negative response to what you're trying to do in bringing the race to Israel?
Io sono convinto che non riusciremo mai.
Yes, of course, I expect some negative response, but the thing that I want to make it clear that we are not here for political reasons at all. And we didn't come here to give a political approval to Israel. We are here because the unique opportunity that was leading these ways towards and this sport towards a real globalization. The fact is that there has always been a talk about globalization, but this is a real step in the direction of taking an event and a sport like cycling in a country that shouldn't even be possible to think about a few years ago. So that was the reason. So there's nothing to do with politics.
Were there to be a rider or perhaps a member of staff at RCS or a sponsor of RCS and the race who decided or felt uncomfortable taking part in this event for political or religious reasons, what would be the response from RCS in that instance?
Se un soggetto individuale, libera scelta.
Well, if a team, obviously, like specifically on the riders, a team has got a roster, and if one of the guys doesn't want to participate, the team usually have 27 riders, so there are plenty of other options. But you need to consider that the Israeli Cycling Federation is member of the UCI, is member of the CIO, and they've got rights to organize races, and so it would be very difficult to say at the level of sport policy, no, Israel not, because there are not the premises. Mm. I do a sport event, and we have no political connection in any shape or form. And it needs to be clarified that despite the name of the event is Giro d'Italia, this is not an event, is an event organized by a private organization and not by the Italian country, and so there is no political political aspect and there is no political connection in between Italy and Israel. This is a private event named Giro d'Italia that is coming to do sport and not politics in a territory.
La comunità internazionale ha riconosciuto a Israele.
But the Giro has been very careful to race in the part of the land that has been recognised by the international community to Israel.
Mauro Venier of the Giro d'Italia. You're listening to the Ruler podcast with me, Ian Parkinson, Ian Cleverly and Paul Maunder. Paul, let's start with cyclocross. What prompted you to write the book Rainbows in the Mud?
Well, I was very much enthusiastic about the sport when I was a young lad, when I was in my teens, and then I sort of fell away from it in my 20s and 30s and came back to it when I had young children and had a lot of time to kill when the children were up very early in the morning and watching their iPads. So I sort of gravitated back towards watching Belgian live broadcasts of cross races.
With the Belgian commentary?
With the Belgian commentary, of course. You need the Belgian commentary. It adds the flavour.
It's not the same if you get... I mean, it's great that it's on Eurosport with English commentary now, when it is, but it's not the same as watching some shaky feed with a language you don't understand.
Exactly, yeah. And you need the little nuances which they pick up on and the ooh, yeah, and the strange noises some of the commentators can make.
Yeah, it's the admonition. I can't remember the guy's name, the main guy on Sporza, but it's the ay and tusk. You know, when it goes wrong, that always comes out.
Yeah, and oosh, and and it's a universal language. I think we can all understand that. So I got back into the sport, started watching it, went over to a few races, wanted to know more, but when I've looked online and in bookshops, there weren't any, or very few books in English language about the sport. There was some books about how to do it, but I had no intention of actually doing it at that time. So I thought, well, there's a gap in the market. I can research one and have some fun doing so.
Was there anything that particularly surprised you about cyclocross when you started looking into the history and looking into the scene at the moment?
I think the common perception is that it's a very Belgian thing, and that's the heartland, and it's always been so. But actually, that's not really the case. It's the heartland has moved. It originated in France, and actually for a while Switzerland was really the centre of the cross scene. It's only really since the early to mid-80s that the Belgians have been prevalent. And I think on a more sort of emotional level, I was quite taken with how much of a community it is. Although it's a very professional sport and quite hard-nosed in some ways, it's very family-oriented, and you can think that about Belgian culture generally without wishing to stereotype. But at the races, all the racers will have their own crew, but usually it'll be their uncle, their auntie, their mum, their dad, their brothers, people from their village. It's not the same kind of hard-nosed commercial setup that road cycling is.
Well, that was one of the things that surprised me reading the book. First of all, that Switzerland was so dominant for so long in the sport, but also that even at quite a high level, some of the riders are effectively part-time, and a lot of the crews, the mechanics, the soigneurs, the drivers, they're largely unpaid.
Yes, and I think most of them would do it for the love of the sport, but also the love of their family members and to support their family members. I met many middle-aged Belgian aunties who had been coming to races every weekend in the camper van for 25 years and seeing their friends there, having a glass of schnapps, sharing around some biscuits, and it seemed like it was a kind of a social scene of all of its own.
And there's that phenomenon of the supporters clubs, which is unlike, I think you get something a bit similar in Italy and some bits of France, but it's a very unique Flandrian sort of tradition, that, isn't it?
It is, and it's very geographically based. So they're based around one rider and then one town or village, often.
And frequently one bar or one cafe.
Yes, yeah. And they have coach trips to the big races. They have parties at the end of the season. And it's a sort of made-to-measure supporters club for the rider, and they can make some noise out in the course and
matching puffer jackets, of course.
That's
very important.
Yes.
Otherwise you might just end up in the wrong crew by mistake.
Yes, and that would be a bad mistake to make.
Matching puffer jackets in shades of grey.
Grey or dark blue with some white stitching on the back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And drinking seems to be quite an important part of it.
I was quite surprised to find that beer is not so much a part as I thought. I thought that it was all about the beer. Actually, most of the supporters clubs, if they go week in, week out, they realise that it costs £2 for a pint or whatever it is, and that's quickly stacks up if you go and add the bus trip and the ticket price to get in. So they tend to smuggle in bottles of schnapps or gin or whiskey or whatever is their tipple. Works out cheaper.
Do you think it's too Belgian? Do you think that the sport is being held back by being a little parochial when the rest of cycling is internationalising for good or ill?
Certainly the UCI would like to globalise, which is a word I'm ambivalent about, but they would like to take it further afield. You could see a scenario where you start the season in, say, Australia, Japan, move to America, and then come to the European heartland in October, November. The Belgian setup is very effective because it's a virtuous circle of sponsors, TV coverage and crowds, but it is very insular, and if one of those components starts to break down, then the Belgian scene is at risk. And actually the season I was there, two seasons ago, the attendance at races was coming down a bit and people were blaming the ticket prices, or they could go and see some ice hockey or whatever it is. But for the sport's future, it would be on a safer footing if it was a bit broader.
But it's tricky, I guess, for a sponsor like Telnet, who sponsor one of the biggest outfits, they're just not really interested in selling anything outside Belgium, really, are they?
No, indeed. And that's why we need some more international sponsors to come in. And so far that's been the likes of Trek and the bike companies. And there's a clear advantage for them because they want everyone to buy a cross bike in addition to their road bike and their mountain bike and their gravel bike. So, all power to that.
Has anyone worked out the difference between a gravel bike and a cross bike? Because they look like cross bikes to me.
The name.
Ah, okay. That's it, is it?
That's it.
Yeah. And you ride on gravel, not mud.
Oh, yeah.
The American scene is very different, isn't it?
Yes, it's much more participation-based. So in Belgium, the scene is based on elite racing, and then the people who go to watch the racing would probably never dream of getting on a bike. It's entertainment, and it's professional entertainment. In America, they have many, many races from 8-year-olds all the way up to 75-year-old veterans, plus single-speed races and kind of comedy races too. And they have maybe up to 5,000, 6,000 competitors in the national championships, and they bring their families, everyone in the family races, and then goes and watches the events. It's a different model. Whether it's better or worse, I can't say. I think we in Britain are tending more towards the American version at the moment.
It's also to do with the phenomenal distances involved in the States. So the big races will be two races over an entire weekend, won't they? So you race on the Saturday and the Sunday, because, you know, if you've got to fly several states away in just to do a race, it's a long way to go for 45 minutes or an hour of racing.
Yeah.
Belgium, you know, you can drive to any race anytime. Yeah. So it's different.
And on the Sunday, on the second day, they reverse the course. So you ride it in reverse, which adds a bit of a twist.
Of course, the season starts, you know, this year with Jingle Cross in Iowa. Why is it called Jingle Cross if it's in September?
Good question. It used to be in December. Okay. And so there is... All the references are to the Grinch series of books. And there's a Grinch alongside running around and causing a nuisance. But when they got elevated to World Cup status, the UCI put them in September. So there must have been some strange conversations around branding at that point and whether to keep the name or...
And keep the Grinch.
And yeah, I think they have, but he's a lesser figure in September.
I mean, Christmas does start earlier every year, Ian. You just got to go with it. Except it's now in September.
You see, I can't see the Belgian fans particularly taking to the Grinch running around the course.
No. And I didn't see much Grinch activity in Belgium either.
It's strange, isn't it, that the season begins in America and then the majority of the rest of the races are within... It's not even Belgium. It's actually quite a small part of Belgium.
Yes, it's Flanders, with the exception of Namur. Even the Dutch races, Hoogerheide does okay, but a lot of the Dutch races struggle to get the spectator numbers. So I think I would quite like the scene to broaden so that we've got Swiss, French, Dutch, Belgian, UK races, potentially. But it's the economic model. We need the fans and the TV coverage to land before you can make it happen.
Well, you're involved in an attempt to bring a World Cup race to London. In fact, it was at Milton Keynes a few years ago. How's that going? What stage has that reached?
Pretty good. It started off as a bit of a joke between myself and Brooke Watts, who organises Cross Vegas. I was trying to get him to come and do Cross Vegas on Blackheath, which he politely declined, which is fair enough. But after a while, I just thought, let's see what we can get going. So I'm working with a few people, including Simon Burney, who's well known in the cross world and mountain biking world, and various other people in the events world, to try to put together a credible bid for a London World Cup. All the reception from the UCI and British Cycling have been positive so far. It would be a 3-year contract, so it would be 18, 19, 20. And if it works out, we could bid for a World Championships in London. The Lee Valley Park, the Queensborough Olympic Park, has got the space and actually the terrain as well for a really good cross course. It's not cheap, though, so you need somewhere around 400, 500 grand to do it. And the challenge so far is attracting in sponsors where you have to explain cross and explain the drama and intensity and the benefits of it for them.
So you don't have 400, 500 grand in your back pocket?
No. Does Rouleur have that?
Pass.
We've got a lot of good conversations going on with sponsors, both inside and outside the bike industry. I think a lot of people recognise that cross is the fastest growing part of UK cycle sport. And in London, it's really growing fast, really popular. It's great accessibility for children and families to have a go. And there's potentially a good piece to link up with the broader London cycling strategy and how we encourage kids to just get on their bikes and feel more confident on their bikes.
Because cross is a great way of getting kids started and also riding and learning how to handle their bikes really well in safety, isn't it?
Yes, and you can they can race around a smaller, slightly easier track on grass, have fun doing so, and if they fall off, it's generally a pretty soft landing. So we're talking to Transport for London and the London Mayor's Office about how we can perhaps create a children's festival alongside the World Cup.
So you've written about Tom Pidcock in Ruler 17.7. He is, of course, junior cyclocross champion, but there's a lot more to him than that, isn't there? He's a remarkable talent.
Absolutely. So I didn't know Tom before I went to interview him for the day. I saw him win the World Championships in Luxembourg and just the ease with which he rode around that horrifically icy and steep course. You got the sense that he can do anything he wants on a bike. He's got the kind of natural bike handling skills of a Mathieu van der Poel, but at 5 years younger. But it was quite a surprise to me to learn that he doesn't really practice on his cross bike. He hardly ever rides it, in fact. It was hanging at the back of his shed somewhere. He just rides his road bike. And he was saying that when he went out to meet his new team and met Sven Nys for the first time, he told them that and they were blown away and a bit shocked, I think.
I was equally blown away when I read that line in the piece.
Yeah.
You know, when he says, well, I don't really practice on my cross bike. And it was like, seriously?
Yeah.
How do you get that good with it, you know?
I'm not quite sure what the answer is to that question, but he certainly has been riding his bike since he was 6 or 7 years old and has always rode to school on it. And there's just, you get the impression he's lived his young life on two wheels.
And one of the issues for sort of young British cross riders is that actually British cycling at the moment doesn't really support cross that much, does it? It tends to go road or mountain bike because that's where the Olympic medals are potentially. But Tom Pidcock is presumably going to have to make up his mind at some point as to where he's going to focus his career.
He was saying that the plan is for the next couple of years to focus on cross. His contract with Telenet is, I think, for 2 years. That will take him to 20 years of age. But he'll ride the road during the summer. I got the sense that his heart probably lies on the road most of all, actually, and his ambitions do. Certainly he's not limiting himself in terms of ambition. He talked about Paris-Roubaix as his dream race, and he won the junior version, so absolutely why not? I think he could do anything he wanted to. Historical challenge has been that UK and British riders have been tempted by the money of the road scene, and who can blame them for that?
How did he come across? Because he's what, 18 now, isn't he? How did he seem to be handling all these multiple titles and all this attention?
He certainly handles them very easily. It comes quite naturally, I think, to him. I'd seen his rather flamboyant victory salutes and just his riding style, and expected him to be equally kind of flamboyant and maybe a bit leery in the way 18-year-old lads can be. But actually he was very, quite serious, quite focused. He listens. You can tell that he really listens to what you're saying and absorbs and thinks it through. You can tell he's just very dedicated to his sport and committed to it.
It'd be good to see him racing cross in London, wouldn't it?
That's part of my plan, yeah. If we could get him to win in the rainbow jersey in London, that'd be pretty special.
I have to say, photo shoot wise, that's the best photo shoot we've ever done with a rider. He was just off the scale. And it's not like Benedict was asking him to do stuff. He was like, all right, there's a big rock over there. I'll just go and bunny hop on top of it and then bounce around for a bit and then get down. And some of the stuff he was doing was just amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. But having had a coffee with his mum beforehand, I was watching that feeling slightly nervous.
Yes, I bet. Yes, Benedict was equally nervous. Well, I think one of my favourite shots of the whole piece is so Benedict says, Tom says, do you want to come up and see my room? He says, yeah, sure. And he gets out there, do you want to see my Oakley collection? And he opens a drawer and he's got about like 20 pairs of Oakleys in there. And Benedict thinks, 17-year-old, what's going to work here? He says, I wonder how many of those Oakleys you could wear at one time. Before you know it, it's like his head is covered back to front in Oakleys.
Yeah.
Yes, great shot.
Okay, controversial issue now. Beards in pro cycling. Beards in cycling, full stop. Paul, you've got a very fine beard there.
Thank you.
And I have a much less impressive one. It's hard to think, though, of that many bearded top pros, isn't it, really? Sort of, you know, we can exclude Bradley Wiggins' various experiments and Peter Sagan, because Peter Sagan is, you know, Peter Sagan, you know. Mm-hmm. But other than that, there aren't that many, apart from Simon Geschke, currently riding for Sunweb. And he's got a fine set of whiskers on him, and he's also brought out his own beard balm. And Ian, you went all the way to Canada just to speak to him about it.
That's exactly why I went all the way to Canada. It was well worth it, well worth it.
Yeah, it started 2 years ago with Charlotte. She's from Belgium. She is a big cycling fan. Her husband has a beard, so one day she produced a handmade beard balm for him because he didn't like the products he bought so far, and he really liked her product. And then, they watched the Tour de France and they saw me having a beard. And decided she decided to give me a sample at the Eneco Tour a few months later, and she also gave me her telephone number for feedback. She wanted to know if I like it or not, so I contacted her a few weeks later actually, and asked her if she would like to sell it a little bit bigger, and that's when it started, and she really liked the idea. And that's how Geschke Beard Balm was born in the end, yeah.
Being a bearded man yourself, are there any other riders in history in the peloton that you think, you know, that's a top beard? Have you got a top five of bearded riders?
I have to say, the first time I saw a bearded cyclist was Sean Eadie, Australian.
Yeah.
Former sprint world champion. And my dad, I watched it together with my dad because he's also a former sprint world champion, and that's the first time I saw someone with a big beard on a bike. I thought, oh fuck, that guy looks really cool. So, but back then I was 10 years old, so it was a long time before I could grow a proper beard. And but that I remember that was the first beard I saw on the bunch, or not in the bunch, but on the bike. So that would be my all-time favorite actually, and. Top five is actually really hard. There are many bearded cyclists, but not really a famous one, I think.
Do the guys in the peloton take the mickey out of you? Do they like have a joke about your beard, or is it like
all the time?
Yeah.
It's also. I mean, I know all the jokes now, so they keep repeating itself. Whenever it rains, it's like, you must be nice and warm with your beard. So, no, it's not working like that.
It's just jealousy, let's face it.
Because
they just can't do it.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about that, the heat thing. In a hot race, must get hotter.
When it's hot, you know, I don't think the beard changes much. It's not that I really think, oh man, I really would like some air on my chin now. I just, and it's like hair, you don't feel it after a while, it's not much hotter.
And are there any disadvantages to having a beard?
Yeah, it's the most annoying thing is actually when you spill a gel, and you have a gel in the final, and you, by accident, it runs down your mouth, and you have it in your beard, and there's no chance to get it out, and you have to wait. It has to stay there till you have a shower on the bus, so that's definitely not the nicest part.
Have they done aerodynamic studies?
They did. They did special. I think one famous bike brand in the wind tunnel, and they tested it actually, and it was a margin of a disadvantage aerodynamically. It was like on 10 kilometers with 40k an hour, it was like 0.2 seconds or something. So really, it doesn't have a disadvantage, I would say.
Simon Geschke there. Ruler quiz time. On the last edition, we asked what was the name of the cycle courier character played by Michael Smiley in the TV series Spaced. And the answer, of course, was Tyres O'Flaherty. Ian, do we have a winner?
We do have a winner. The winner is Amos Field Reed, a fine name and I'm sure a fine gentleman. He wins a Ruler T-shirt. And you're going to want to know what the question is this podcast, aren't you?
Do we have a cyclocross-themed
question? We do indeed have a suitably cyclocross-themed question. Tom Pidcock won the Cyclocross World Champs in Luxembourg last year. Who was second?
Who was second in the World Championships to the Junior World Championships to Tom Pidcock in Luxembourg last year? Go to the Rulo website, find the podcast page, and there should be a full description of how to enter there. And the prize is...
a Rulo T-shirt,
A fine Rulo T-shirt. Yeah. OK, that's it for this podcast. Thanks to Paul Maunder for coming along. Thanks to Ian Cleverley. Speak soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.